fact is that in the study of biblical narrative, Rashi is sometimes going to bog us down. We want to have a bit like a bigger picture. Big picture of Rashi is like Ramban, sometimes Rahmel, where you're not commenting on every pasuk or every second pasuk.
It kind of reminds me of the two ways people take notes. Like either they have, like they write in the margins of the source sheet, or they write in a totally separate notebook. It's like Rashi's like writing in the source sheet and just explaining like a thing within the pasuk versus Ramban is giving you like a whole.
Of course, because Rashi has nothing else. You know, Rashi's biggest accomplishment is that he wrote his commentary without Rashi.
Yeah.
So that's also something. I'm did very much having the page in front of us, so I have an office here. Everyone else went to Gluck all these years, but I kept my office here in this building. So I was able to store all this art that I bring to my shul. My shul is a great repository of Seamus. Everybody in the West Side brings us their Seamus. So plus it was. Not so much anymore, but when I first moved to the West Side, there was just so many Gedolei Torah. Really, some who taught at the seminary, some who taught at different places. I've met about 10 such cases, never, what I'm about to describe to you, where the parents died, right? Left the house filled with Sfarim, and no children wanted them. So I made this deal with the painters, companies that have painted out the poem because they're just told, right, throw everything out and just paint your poem. So the painters would call me and say, listen, we're about to put out in the street. Just in front. It's not. Megillas Esther. I have got 5 Megillas Esthers that I got. Some in pretty good shape. Crazy stuff. Otherwise, garbage truck picking them up. So I have an office here. I put all the Tanakh stuff I've accumulated over the years. So I have a shelf of Rashi's, a shelf of Shmos. So that's why I was able to just come up with $60 in my office. I have another 20 downstairs. I can't throw them out. I used to be the kid rabbi at Kibbutz Marashah for many years. So we used to have on Tisha B'Av, we would bury all the shamans. It's crazy. The schools are fresh. The moms, they give out these $60 to my resident at the end of the year. They just left their school. And they used to bring them up to Camp Marashah. Sometimes we use them. Like Steinsaltz, like hundreds and hundreds of Steinsaltz. Just throwing them in the pit. Very impressive. Okay, enough of that. We're going to read now Shmos Perek. Today, gracious is no bad to these parashas we're reading now, but just keep this in mind. Whatever happens to Avram in Lech Lecha is doubled in Yom Yira. There's the 5 things that happen to him in Lech Lecha. There are parallels in Yom Yira. Okay, our tradition is that these are all part of a growth process of Avram. The Bible critics say no, it's the same story just told from 2 different standpoints. The redactor of Gracious wasn't sure if Abraham went with his wife through Philistia or through Egypt, so he put both stories in. You should know that exists out there. It's called the documentary hypothesis. The criticism does not go to rear its head so much in this class, but the Rav wrote about this first with respect to the 2 creation stories. Right, and 1 and 2, which you probably read in high school. So that's true about almost all stories in certain say gracious, is that the Bible gives you 2 different perspectives, sometimes more. So Abraham in Lech Lecha deals with Sodom when he saves Lot. Abraham in Vayera deals with Sodom. Abraham in Lech Lecha deals with a foreign king that gives his wife something to be concerned with. And also in Vayera, there is a different king, it's a Melech in Philistia. stories because there was some kind of a famine that made it difficult for them to travel out of their home. Right? But both Lech Lecha and Vayera is confronted with some kind of banishment of hope. And see these trends that take place. This is the stuff of this semester. It's for you to recognize these kind of things, these biblical ironies, these biblical trends, so I call it pre-parshanut, because first of all, these are not the kind of things that we should be doing. And as a Rashbam and Rashi and Rambam intended to do this. And you don't think that's not really a Rashi kind of thing to notice. It's possible.
Also, Yishmael is born in Lechacha, and Yitzchak is born in Bayern.
This is certainly Yishmael, stuff. You know, he's confronted with banishing sons, and you know. So, what happens in Bayero that never happens in Lechacha?
Kids
and
stuff.
I mean, from the standpoint of Avraham, how is Avraham in the world? That Avraham does something in all three stories in Bayera that he doesn't do in Lechacha. Now, the parallels aren't exact in this, but in Bayera, he prays in all three. He prays for Sodom, he prays for Yishmael and Mother, and he prays for the Avraham. Hashem tells him, he'll pray for you because he's a no people. He'll pray for you. He doesn't pray in Lechacha. And that's really the key novihu, I think, is one of the most important pesukim in the whole narratives of Avraham. Avraham is a Navi. Because in the climax of Avraham's story is where he calls the name of this mountain Hashem Yeroeh Ki Bahar Asher Yomer Hayom Bahar Hashem Yeroeh. Because what Avraham does is that he assures that God won't only speak to me, but that he'll speak to my descendants and will appear to my descendants prophetically, because he's a Navi, on this very mountain. Which seems to make Ibn Ezra say something radical. It seems to say that pasuk was added in later. How did anybody in the Torah know that's the mountain we're supposed to go? They knew that they've said prophetically in Shira to be able to see Ta'imo Bahanachalostava Holoshit the Papal Hashem, right? To be able to see Ta'imo Be Har Nachalostava. They knew that that place would be Mikdash Hashem, going to the devil, would be on a mountain, but they didn't know which mountain. Amirah, even Moshe always refers to that mountain as a Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem Shekech Moshe. Moshe never mentioned it. Well, Yerushalayim doesn't appear in the Torah. So how does Avraham know? Come on, Ibn Ezra, give us a break. Avraham spoke about, he's a Navi. He said prophetically, God will appear at this mountain. Did everybody know exactly where? How do we know that it was that now? Because when Shlomo goes to the Mishnah, it says he built it on Har Moriah. And everyone went to that. Eretz Moriah to the mountain.
There's a really cool Masay Hashem on the Avraham not dominating until later. It's like really interesting how all things that are happening is Hashem trying to teach Avraham that he's not, that Hashem isn't just a did God, he's also mercy to him.
Because Din doesn't like to change.
Yeah.
Emes is Emes, you know. 3 + 4 is not a whole lot of negotiation about what that is. Right? But Rachamim is flexible. Chesed is flexible. You know? So Hashem is teaching Avraham flexibility between the two. So that's this kind of stuff that this semester will try to do. And it doesn't lend itself so much to please read this Kreshan and this Pasuk. So what it will lend itself, however, is what I'll bring in. We have a class on Tuesday in this term. So I will bring in some English readings. Right? So maybe what I'll do is, can I just give it to you? These are out of print. So these are chapters, various chapters from different books that are in your syllabus. Because I wasn't able to push it. It didn't happen. So if I give it out, one of you can make it available to art of reticence. Did you see that one? The art of reticence. You get what it means? Reticence is that the Tanakh's derech is to speak in a voice of terseness and a voice of
I don't think it's about a question. It would just like to have like a little more structure would be awesome. I just like to have a little bit more structure would be great.
Right. So maybe this is something you can read on. It's not a whole lot. It looks like a lot because it's a page and a half, but it's just one page of each thing. It's called Characterization and the Art of Restlessness. It's not by Robert Olter. Okay. So I'll make that available to you in this class and that will help you answer some of the questions in the tonight. But this course does not lend itself as much as the Shmuel course about hardcore Arbanels and, the models and the poses. So but I'll try to
thanks
maybe
you.
Put that in there. I'm sorry? I will tell it's in the syllabus. I'm not sure. Maybe I think the art of biblical narrative should be online, right?
The
art of biblical narrative. I'm sure you can buy it online. Buy the book. If the whole book is available to you online.
You just bought it.
Huh? it's not. I have it here in the office. It's a small one. It's a small soft cover book. Called Characterization in the Art of Reticence. It's worthwhile time. Okay, it's called The Art of Biblical Narrative. Then you can follow up with a book called The Art of Biblical Poetry, which is sort of volume 2 in the step. But let me take more from the first one. Okay. So week 3 has questions about discrepancies in syntax. Now that's usually the stuff that Rashi or even possibly even Ezra bothers with. But sometimes a discrepancy in syntax can really, I think it came up in one of our first classes, can really identify and give you some important background to the story. Okay, what's a discrepancy in syntax is when you have plural subject but a singular verb, or vice versa. That's often the discrepancy. It's by Yavo Moshe Aharon, by Yikach Shemer Yefes, in this week's Rashi. Right? There are generally two approaches to this, I'll say three approaches. One is Ibn Janah, Ibn Janah is probably one of the major influences on Ibn Ezra. Ibn Janah was a Sephardic grammarian. Yonah Ibn Janah is his name. Ibn Ezra often calls him just Rabbein Yonah, Rabbein Yonah, not to be confused with the commentary to the Talmud. Okay. Ibn Janah ignores these discrepancies. So that's a positive why. The discrepancy should be both plural subject, plural verb. He says because Ibn Janah's approach is once something happens more than once, and it means that maybe in a Hebrew class or in your book you should write it syntactically parallel, but the Bible doesn't care about syntactical parallelism. It's Ibn Janah. Once something happens more than once, right? Who does it describe? Ibnay Tomim Bivitna. And there were twins in the belly. Who is that? That's Rivka. The twins are not when they said, but this word is extremely deficient. It's missing an aleph and a yud. So Ibn Ezra on the pasuk says, he quotes Ibn Janah and he says, he knows what Rashi writes about it. Right? Because there's only one other twin in the Tanakh. It's
Perez and Zerah.
There it's spelled Tehomim. So Rashi says, here both of them were tzaddikim, here one was a rasha. I like Rashi, Rashi's fact that he asks the question influenced a lot of commentaries, but I'm not sure I love what Rashi does with it. When you say Rashi, then he's a Rashi at birth. Right? Now, I might have said that these, I don't know, I have no proof of this, of course, that these were identical twins. So the word for Tomin is vulgar. These were not identical twins, so the word for twins is defective. How do I know they weren't identical twins? Well, the Tanakh describes them the way they were born. So, and they look very different. Okay, anyway, Ibn Ezra quotes, we don't have Janach's original work, even though he says from Ibn Ezra. So he says, Ibn Janach says that, look at all these places in the Tanakh where Aleph's and Yud's fall out. And he quotes a bunch of them. Rishis Shana, Abach Rishis Shana, Rishis is spelled without the Aleph. Right? So he says, once it happens, a few times, nothing there. You get it?
Oh, look, he's saying, look, it happens all these times, not significant.
Yeah, because, but why? Now you see why Ibn Ezra wasn't nearly as possible, as popular as Rashi. The Shabbos Ibn Ezra, Aleph's fall out. Why does it fall out here? That's what made Rashi more popular. Rashi sort of answered questions. Ibn Ezra's answer would be to that. The answer is touche. The answer is, of course you should look into why the Aleph isn't there. Good looking gracious rabbi for that. My parish is pshat. There is no pshat reason why this Aleph is missing. And if there's no pshat reason why this Aleph is missing, I'm not going to put it in. I'm not going to put it into my parish. Get it? I'm not saying you shouldn't read gracious rabbi. That's where you'll find an answer to that question. Okay? All good? Alright, so I just want to be able to give you the information here. Just to look up some of these cases of inconsistency syntactically between subject and verb. In some cases, it's to teach that they're both acting as a unit. That's usually the case with Moshe and Aaron. Moshe and Aaron, almost half the time, get a singular verb when they're doing something together. Isn't that crazy? But you vote, but you shot, not but you shvoo. Why? So remember there's a pasuk, who Moshe Aaron, who Aaron and Moshe, remember? So Rashi there says they were equals. Of course Moshe was greater, but the proof that Aaron never knew that Moshe was so much greater than he was. You think of that? Yeah?
He was when
correct. And Moshe wasn't such an honor of. His brother would have known L'chadchila to tell Miriam, we talk this way. You don't know. We can have marital relationships even though God talks to us, but he can't. Aaron didn't know that. Yes.
Also, for Yitzchak and Abraham, when they come back from Yitzchak, this is by Yishev
Shneihem. Yeah, there is a lot of my goodness, because they don't see Yitzchak. Especially for the Chazal, I'd say that the events would take place one after the other. Yeah. So Eichum Shneim Yachdov. That's such a big important point in the story. Is that they're doing something together. Okay. But in this week's parasha, by Yikach Shem Lo Yefes, right? By Yikach Shem Lo Yefes, there, Rashi points out that, it's a whole different approach. It's not that Shem and Yefes are acting as one, but
one follows the other.
Right? One just follows the other. One is acting. They try to do it on one.
That's
the
third approach.
Yes, yeah. The first approach is to disregard it. Second approach, they're acting as one. often Moshe and Aaron. Third approach is picked up. Now, very often, which one of these three approaches will present itself to you immediately, and you will be a good judge of which is which. I think. Just be aware of it. Look for it. You're going to be teaching Chumash all of you one day. Whether it's for your own progeny, or it's to students, or to large groups, or something. So be aware of it. Okay? Now, when this week's parasha says, Vayavo Noach, Upanav, Ishto, Meshevanav, which is saying, Vayavo Hu. So then it's interesting. Not as a comment to this pasuk, but as a statement from gracious Rabbi, the Medrash Tanhuma, one that the family deserved to go within, and one that they didn't. In other words, one that they're coming on as equals. We all put an effort to make this thing happen, and then we know the state of the world. And one that, no, they're just coming on because they have to be related to God. So maybe this is bad. Okay. Okay, I'm doing some questions in week three already, but just helping along, and you'll is that when we have a syntactical reference to a whole entire group, that mamash includes everyone, no exception, we will usually be in singular. Like Vayichan, Betach Tisachar, or Vayichan, or Shema Yisrael, Yisrael tends to be singular. Yisrael Betach Hashem. But when you refer to a part of the whole, like one is singular, but one tenth is going to be plural. So it's Beis Aaron, which is a part of the whole, is Bitchu Hashem. Yomar no Yisrael, but Yomru no Beis Aaron. Get it? The Torah says in the same parsha, Parshas Bahar, the Sefarta Loch, Sheva Shasot Shanim, Sheva Shanim, Sheva Ve'amim. Count the Yovel years. The Sefarta Loch. But another pasuk in the same parsha, Sfartem Lochem, no, that's not, that first one is in Bahar, the second one is in Bahar. Sfartem Lochem. Sheva, 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 with 7 weeks. Pesach and Shavuos, so Spartan Lochem means counting intuitively. Every one of you count the Omer. But the Yovel is only counted by the Nasi. Okay, again, it's part of the Loch, one of you count the Yovel. Spartan Lochem here, it means every one of you count the Omer. So this is sort of switching from what we said before about unit and the individual. That's how the Gemara and Malachos understands the difference. Gemara asks, why does one say Sparta Loch? One says Sparta Lochem. So it says Sparta Lochem, each and every one of you count the Omer. Sparta Loch, one of you representing everybody count the Omer. Okay. Alright, while I was adding, I put in, but I think we did this last year. In Rus Perik Aleph, there was a syntactical nightmare. Not of singular and plural, but of male and female. Right? In Hebrew, male and female has to be syntactically congruent, right? If you have a female subject, you have to have a female pronoun. And nouns. Verbs. Yasa Shem Lochem Chesed Kasher Asisem Imanim. Women get a nun, not a man. What are all these men doing in verse Perek Aleph? Okay. So that I think if you're reading a translation, you're not going to get that, of course. But you're steeped in reading the original Hebrew, so that's good. Can you think of a drash? Have you ever heard a drash why there's so many. I mean, there's even a hermaphrodite word in Rus Paragal of shtehem. There's no such word. It's either shtehem or shnehem. Shtehem returned from Moab to Yehuda. Can you? This, because this is the stuff of this class. Go ahead. Go to stage two. Why does Rus Perek Aleph conflate men and women so often? What's going on? Clear story in chapter one of six people, and what happens?
I mean, all the men die.
All the men are dying, and the women are surviving and creating a kingdom.
They don't know.
They
step up into seemingly a male role. They take charge.
Yeah, wouldn't be normally in Moab, it wouldn't be the women who would have to bury the women aren't usually outlive their husbands, but they got someone else, but there was no one there. So they did things that men normally have to do. And the women are building the kingdom. You know, some just seem a lot of melech, but it's the women who built the kingdom. Right? Three of them at first, and then one stepped away, but still, that's really what the story is about. You got women stepping in to create the kingdom. So that creates like a background. You create this background. It's just like a milat mancha kind of background. We're about to see one in Yomen, we're about to see one in Shmos Karabes. I'll get to both of them today. So that is what's happening in Rus Paragal. So I think that's the pshat. Now, of course, you can have someone who say the pshat is some copyist made a mistake. Rus has been copied over with those mistakes for so many hundreds and hundreds and even a few thousand years. Come on, who am I in the 20th century or 19th century all of a sudden to wake up and say people have been reading this book along for 1900 to 3000 years? So that's not the traditional way to go about this. That doesn't need to be said, but I'm just saying. Shot is that it gives you an overall background. A drash is in Rus Rabbah, which is one of the oldest midrashim that we have. Rus Rabbah was written before almost all the other rabbis together with Horatius and Bayeko. We can tell by the people who are in there. And the Eretz Yisrael Aramaic style. How do we even know what that is? How do you know a midrash comes from Eretz Yisrael? I'll give you a few telltale hints that you'll see right away. Names that begin with an aleph, the aleph falls away. And if you know you're in an Eretz Yisrael, that's just the way they did. If you Talmud Yerushalmi does it. There's no Rabbi Eliezer in Talmud Yerushalmi. There's Rabbi Eliezer. There's Rabbi Lozer. It's not a 99 Rish. There's no Rabbi Abba. There's Rabbi Bol. Now, sometimes you will see the aleph get in, sometimes, but usually it's it disappears, yes.
It's kind of like how in Malchus Yisrael, they don't have the who at the end.
That's the Gemara in Erevim that talks about that. About the vav falling out in Tanakh. There is a trend to it. There is a book called Hamikra VaHamasora. If you don't have it, try to get it. It's a rare book. Hamikra VaHamasora. The author is Reuven Margolius. It's only about 90 pages, the whole book. But you will love each chapter is like 3-4 pages. You will love each one. It's a Tanakh. Hamikra VaHamasora. It's written by Reuven Margolius. He's known more famously as the Margolius Hayom for his commentary from Sefer Sanhedrin. Reuven Margolius. He's written about 80 Sfarim. He's a contemporary, but in the sense he's not alive. He's a contemporary. Hamikra VaHamasora. So he writes about that. That's chapter one of the trend in the book. So Rus Rabbah says that the trip from Moab to Yehuda went through what's called the Gaon HaYarden, which is a very dangerous trip. And they had to dress like men, otherwise they would have been assaulted. Okay, if you know that, good. Tradition, that's what they did. and see if you have some ideas on this. There is a story where men seem to dress up as women. And I think it's good shot. It says it's easy at least. Okay. There are two men who assassinate a king and somehow get his head outside of the palace. Do this one's the and the Tanakh bothers to tell us how they got into the palace. They killed some deliverers of wheat, right? Remember that? And they took the delivery and they knocked on the door and says, "We have your wheat." He goes, "Oh yeah, we expect the delivery wheat." They got in, they killed the guy at the door, and then they made their way to the king, who was sleeping. Who am I talking about, by the way?
Ishbosheth
is correct. The two who killed him were Rehob and Baana. And when they left, it says the Nun. Not he, but he. Definitely. Well, she's a Shaul's son. Shaul Beth-Perek. Shaul Beth-Perek Dalet. Shaul Beth-Perek Dalet. It says, Hainah. They, feminine, left the palace with the king's head to present to Dalet. We'd have to get a big surprise for Dalet. Right? Can you be creative? Yeah. One of them pretended to be pregnant, they dressed up as women, and that's how they got their head out. So they probably said, okay, let them out. They didn't frisk them. Okay? Alright, so that's the second answer of why these women have so many masculine pronouns. Third answer, by the way, this is just getting you for just to show the creativity of a Pashtun. The third answer, another purpose of telling you this is I'd like to, in each class, expose you to a lot of different sparim that are out there for you to use when you make it at home. Okay? I'm sure all of you have heard of the Torah to be, right? The Baruch HaLevi Epstein, the son of the Orach HaShulchan. Torah Tamima, his work is the text, Onkelos, Rashi, and whatever Gemara comments on that text, right? And then he has his comments at the bottom, what Gemara saw in the Pasuk to say what it says. Torah Tamima is essentially not a commentary to the Torah, it's a commentary to the Gemara's on the Torah. Clear? Torah Tamima wrote another work called Tosefes Bracha. Tosefes Bracha. And like the Torah Tzvima, it's not only on the Chumash and Shitorah, but it's on the Chumash and Gilos also. There's 20 commentaries altogether, 10 on Chumash, 10 on Gilos, right? And in this commentary to Rus, he posits the following. Torah Tzvima died in the early 30s. He posits that in Moabite, they don't differentiate between masculine and feminine. So I think that they got so used to speaking in one gender, and they started to say they instead of he or she, right? They got so used to speaking in one gender that the chapter one reflects that condition. It doesn't tell us why chapter one would reflect that and what in other places. Okay, but they got used to it, shows it's a sign of their assimilation. They wait so long to come back. Okay. Alright.
This is in the door.
We give us Rus, the Tosefes Brach. Okay. Parenthetically, and I love the Torah Tzvi, but he's wrong. You should have known. You should have known better. Before you write something like this, the Torah Tzvi was paid for doing this. It's going out on a limb on something. Because Moab, they were originally messing with them. Did he have anything at his disposal to determine whether that was true or not? The fact is, Moabite has left us so little information. Very little Moabite. It's less than a lot of Ammonite stuff. Very little Moabite stuff. That that relates directly or indirectly in the Bible. But you know, HaKol Tolu V'Mazal. The fact is, there is one Moabite find. You probably learned about it in high school, in college. I was teaching in my intro class. There's one Moabite find that you should have known. The original is in copies of it in museums all over the world. It's called the Meshach Stone. This is new to all of you. The Meshach Stone, and the S-H-A. This is a king that's mentioned in Tanakh, the beginning of Malachi Bet, fighting a battle against the northern tribes, right? And he carved out a stone. It says his name. It starts off, "I am Mesha, king of Moab, and I'm fighting a battle with the Israelites." And the battle is the exact parallel to what's written in Tanakh. It's just one little difference. And it's not that we won the war in the Mesha stone. But let's not quibble about that. We win the war because we're still here and we get to decide how history is written. Or we could describe different parts of the war. We recently found a diary in Poland that was buried about a Polish cavalryman celebrating the fact that on September 1st, 1939, the horses are advancing against the German army. He was probably killed that day. You know what I'm saying? Is that, you know, so someone wrote about, you know, like, didn't the Egyptians and Jordanians, or the Egyptians especially, tell on the third day of the Six-Day War, broadcast on the radios how their tanks are running over Tel Aviv?
Oh, yeah.
That's why Jordan joined the war. Which is how we kind of, how we took the Kotel. Yes?
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify, for the
Megillah
group, the discrepancy between, like, women being associated with, like,
pronouns.
We gave like the two reasons for it. The first being that they stepped up, and the second being it was just a sign of their submission.
So this, the second is that it's a midrashic, because there's nothing in the text that indicates besides that they dressed up as men. Right? And I gave you a parallel story where men are dressed up as women because they get in them. And only because I use it as part of the same story. How'd they get the head out? How do you get the king's head out of a palace? Right? Isn't someone going to say, hey, what's in that bed? Maybe they have a bowling bag or something. So the third answer is this kind of shot answer of the Torah Tmima, right? It tries to use information that he should have had at his disposal. The Mesha stone does differentiate between masculine and feminine. In other words, Moabite is the closest ancient language to Hebrew. And while they have left us very little in terms of archaeological information, the one thing they have left us is considered one of the most significant archaeological finds that bears directly on the biblical story. It's known as the Mesha stone. About the size of half the size of that building. Right? In between the Moabite characters, you wouldn't, unless you transliterate it, you wouldn't understand what it's saying, because you can read the characters. But once you transliterate it, you're going to say, this is closer to Hebrew than even Aramaic. It's Mamish Hebrew. Okay? It's halfway between Hebrew and Aramaic. Spells of Anna, Mesha, Malka, Demoa, I mean, it's, you know. Okay, that is about discrepancies. When Moshe saves the, you know what, let's do something. We're reading Perek Bet Pasuk Yud Aleph in Shema. Do you have it? Bet Yud Aleph.
Oh, also, this is a bit of an unsubtle, but when we were doing looking at Moshe and the three stories earlier, I thought that's something that I thought was cool, that for each three stories, the first one it's with an up, like which talks about how the bishop is hurting his brother. The second story, it's he's telling them, like, don't hurt your friend, don't slap your friend, like, right? And the third one is gonna, eventually going to be his in-laws. So that's interesting because during the Egel, Moshe tells everyone that the Levim, they should kill everyone, whether they're your Uf, they're your Re'ehu, or your Kruvim.
Wow.
So that's a little...
That is, I'm telling you, I never heard that before. You've uncovered an absolute truth of the Torah. That's number one, you know, the Memtes. Absolutely. Torah works this way. Torah does those things. It's written to find those things. But that's a specific element. What's the larger element?
Yeah.
That these three stories of Moshe, one where he saves the Hebrew from the Egyptian, one where he gets involved with two Hebrews fighting to try to get them to stop, and one where he stands in to save those helpless women as well, are harbingers. They are foreshadowing events of the future. From Korach's revolt to Sihon and Og to everything that happens to Moshe in the rest of the Torah. Fall into one of these three things in the many different ways to categorize them. One is Achrei Akaroth, but yes, it's to find anytime you find something like that, it's like a simcha.
Yeah,
that's
really cool.
Yeah. And it's make your day. It's like the Dunkin' Donuts came up with a new donut. So by Yibay Ibn Mahim, by Yidal Moshe, you want to see it? By Yitzeh El Echol, without the Torah doesn't tell us how he knew that these were his brethren. By Yar Vesiklo Sam, that might be dependent on how old this child was when he went back to his the mother who raised him. Rashi says he was 2 years. It's true. Ramban says he was 13. So if he was 13, he must have been. He knew his brother, he knew his sister, he knew his family, he knew he was a Hebrew, he knew where he was going. Right? Okay. So by Yetzei Elechov, by Yar B'Siflo Sam, he saw in their afflictions, not a common word, Siflo Sam, say well, suppose. By Yar Ish Mitzri, Maket Ish Ivri Menechov. He saw an Egyptian man beating amongst his brethren. Twice it says in the Pasuk's brethren. I just want to read one more Pasuk. Vayithen ko b'cho v'yaki yinish v'yachas ha-mitzri v'yitzmini b'cho. Look this way and that way. He saw no man. So he smote the Egyptian and he buried him in the sand. Not b'cho, but b'cho. In the sand. Okay, this is the stuff of what we're doing in this class. Let's deconstruct these today. Okay? And the purpose here is to find what's called the Milat Mancha. The Milat Mancha, the word that sort of characterizes everything in the background. Basiria.
Bayar.
So Bayar is definitely. It appears three times. Right? Vision. Right? Because how many Vayar do you read? Vayar is the Gosam, Vayar is the Tzri, Vayar is the Yish. I think this one is even more pronounced than the Pasuk like this. Listen to this one. So it's next week's parasha. I'm sorry, 2 weeks ago. It says, Vayar in Nesh Oshan Oshim Yitzavim Alav, Vayar Vayarat Yitzavim.
What's that second Vayar for?
Okay, it's a similar repetition, but not as stark with Yosef when he sees the father of the baker in the jail, and it says twice that he saw something about that. Okay. So you can, it is the. What would you do with this? I mean, this is a simple kind of
from Homestead Institute.
Rashi and not the Moshe says, yes. But fine, that's a drash. Tell me some of your shot. What did that one say? What did that one say?
Oh, I was saying within the context of like, this story, like, the meaning he like saw, like, to really emphasize, not only saw, but he like penetrated into that, like, he like felt it also.
Of course, but one sight is sort of like the sense data. You get used to things. I know what the red light looks like, I know what the green light looks like, I know the sizes and shapes and colors, and I have a, you know, we're wired to have memory about what's safe, what's not safe, what's, you know. So that's something every person can see. But then some people, and this is what Avi is teaching us, Moshe is teaching us, don't be like everybody else, just looking at this thing. And I noticed this morning I came in with my box, my Sefer, and each box is 28, it was pretty heavy, and I had two different bags. And I was struggling to get the door. Two students walked straight in and didn't hold the door open for me. And didn't offer to help me with it. You know, they were rushing this call. They didn't make me a pastor, cast dispersions. But you know, I am so attuned because I wanted to give a Shashem. And on the west side, whenever I see someone carrying any carriage, most 80% of the time, 90% of the time, they say, oh, thank you so much. No, it's okay. I'm going to make it. I have a great day. So, but if they ask for help, I'll walk them to that place. I won't do it if it's mincha starting in 1 minute, then I'm not sure to get in there. And, all right, but if I have the extra 5 minutes, I'll go and I won't come home. It happens all the time. And I, you know, and I say, well, that's my synagogue. And it's such a kiddush Hashem. I know there are so many people's names and different people on the west side. So that's the second thing you have. Open your eyes. That's the mechanei thing, the mechanei thing in the Chum Leibowitz. He does bring this out in this passion. And she has an article this week, I think, that I haven't seen it in 3 years, but I remember it's called Moses Seeks Out His Brethren. So one Vayar is Avram seeing three men in the distance. Big deal. But another one is, oh, they look hungry, they look tired, they look tired too. What can I do to relieve them? It's sort of an empathetic. Okay, but I think that there is a different Vilat Manchot, which requires us to read a little further. But in order to qualify as a Vilat Manchot, are you familiar with this concept? The word has to be extraneous. The pasuk has to pretty much mean the same thing if the word was removed. Right? In other words, I wouldn't be bereft of, without the word vayar, I'd be missing something significant from the pasuk. Right? But there is a word that continues to be mentioned here throughout the story that I didn't need the word even once. Okay, continue reading yourselves with pasuk ches and tes. I'm sorry, not chesed, I'm sorry. You give all your knowledge, it's both. Back to your knowledge and see. This word appears. I mean, in order to qualify as a Milan Mankas, it just appears 3 or 4 or 5 times. But it really, really gets on you.
Ish.
So the word ish creates a background. Creates a just like the masculine pronouns created a framework. Start your story with a framework, and then you can teach. Look how this Rashi fits that framework. Look how this Ramban fits that framework. What's the framework? It's that human beings have been turned into animals. And you know what? How do you know that everyone seems to be okay with that? But it's a homily. Look inside. What words between Pasuk Yudalev and Beis and Gimel seem to mean that everybody's okay with this? Yes?
Maybe when it says
like,
that Moshe like, turns
his
way
now, that
no one cares.
There are the animals here. On both sides. One side is a beast of burden, which is busy making bricks and that brick can work. And the other side carry whips, they're also not human, not human beings. They are the Yenish. Now I'm looking at that globally, but I'll tell you this, there are portion, for instance. Have you heard of the Hakstava HaKabbalah? Hakstava HaKabbalah, that's the name of Mecklenburg in the end of the 19th century. Hakstava HaKabbalah is a quick drash Teirush, tries to fit the drash into the puzzle. He's like a third generation Rashi. 800 years late. It's like there are too many other second generation Rashi's that you know, can't say it. So. Anyway, Mecklenburg says that Vayarki Ish means Moshe could not find a single Egyptian who would stand up for him. No mensch amongst the Egyptians. And then Siv, you've heard of him, he's more famous, right? Hamek Dover. Telling Sviyu who the Berlin. His younger brother was famous Bar Ilan, from whom there was a college in Israel. Forgive me, that was his name. Nuntes, Pasuk Tetzayin. Nuntes 59:15. There is no truth. Whoever turns away from evil is cast aside. And God looked down to see what man is like. And he says, Vayar ki ein ish. It seems that like Yeshayahu was thinking of this Netziv and this Tzav HaKabbalah, right? Vayar ki ein ish. No mention, which might be what animated Hillel in the Pirkei Avos. You know what I'm talking about? So in all these cases, what would that do? Leave it alone with me. Like Dama Shabbatsi Elohava Yarasim, Dama Yarmitzri Maket Ivri Me'echov. Of course they're Ish, they're male humans. That's called Ish. But we're lacking here, but Even kol b'chol b'yar ki yin ish. B'yachas ha-mitzri b'yit b'nei b'chol. B'yit b'nei sh'nei anashim yivrim. Sh'nei yivrim means him. What would be missing if that word anashim wasn't there? See it? Mi sonkol b'ish sarab shofei b'lim. Mi sonkol b'sarab shofei b'lim. So now I want to do the time remaining is to give you some material. Okay? For one, you have this presentation, and then I can share it. Okay? This is actually on reserve. I was able to get this on reserve. The audiobook narrative. There are probably copies in the library. I'm sure there are copies here. Whoever has this here, right?
Yeah.
So the other thing I would like to do is as follows. Two exercises. We should be able to do both of them today, the time remaining. Okay? And this is an exercise in Rashi. Okay, today is the time remaining in Rashi. Rashi creates a background about what Moshe was concerned about here in these stories. And it says, Vayifen ko v'cho v'yak y'nish. Shah is, what was he looking for? What purpose?
So that he's not,
no one can testify. Yes, he gets to testify, which is actually what happened in the heaven. But that is an implication that Rashi does not want to work with. Because it implies that Moshe was vacillating about whether to help this guy or not. No. Moshe's concern is not whether Egyptians are watching me. You see this Rashi? It's a crazy Rashi. And it's a major drama. Rashi never made this. Rashi says that he looked deep into the future to see if killing this man will change history in a way that goes against God's plan. Makes a Navi evolution. God hasn't given him a front push. Okay. But he looked into the future, even ho, all across the cosmos. Killing him isn't going to change anything. That's about your episode where killing that woman changed the whole human history so that they don't even exist anymore and they go back into history to change the history. None of them still have it. It's ever all the people in Star Trek said that was their favorite episode. It's called Sitting on the Edge of Tomorrow.
What happens?
It's time travel. All the ones with time travel always the best ones. Time travel, we have to save the world from the Nazis and Amshman who win World War II because of one isolated event that's one that been changed to this time capsule or something. And then they have to go back and figure out what that event was. It's really very clever. So that's what Moshe did. He went deep into the future and he saw, okay, doing this isn't changing. So when Moshe gets the two Hebrews to stop fighting, they say, oh, you hypocrite. Yesterday you killed someone, and now you're razzing on me for hitting someone? What's the matter with you? So Moshe says, oh no, but you're almost showing your model. You know that at all. So what's Moshe afraid of? It's obvious what he's afraid of. The thing is known, right? And what's the thing that's known? That I killed an Egyptian. What does Rashi say on both of these? Now the thing is known to me why these people suffer more than anybody else. Look at what happens. I try to help them and look how they react. What is he afraid of? I'm afraid maybe these Hebrews don't deserve to be redeemed with the way they're behaving. Rashi, please. Why are you putting those words into Moshe's mind? And furthermore, when Hashem tells him at the end of the story, Moshe, go back to Egypt. All the people who wanted to kill you are dead. Who are those people? Point to Rashi. The two people get to stop fighting. Kind of a shock as that. The people wanted to kill him. It says Paro tried and wanted to kill him, so he escaped. It says in the tweet, Paro died. Maybe the family of the man he killed and buried in the sand, maybe they wanted to kill him too. I don't know.
It's really like the Arabic blood.
It didn't need Shaman. It didn't need, yeah. But it didn't need this, all this mental love. What is Rashi doing? So this is a major point. that creates a background. If you could, every time you teach a story, teach a gift behind a story, teach David Batsheva, get that background. The background by David Batsheva starts off by Yishkav, beginning, he's sleeping in the middle of the day, and at the end, by Yishkav, he gets down on the ground and he mourns and he cries and he begs God's forgiveness. And there's something about that day in the back. So every story, do that. Own it. It's yours. Don't wait to find it in Walter or Sternberg or Kugel or okay. Right? So here, what is Rashi trying to create by having Moshe, and then so I'll feed you some of it to start with and then take the rest of it. He's not afraid of Egyptians. But what is he really afraid of? What is his apprehension in two prokim in Paragimel and Dalet at the bush? Why does he keep on pushing back? Yes,
because the two Jewish people he tracked with.
He feels very unequal to the task of being charged with saving people he has never lived with. For the day I went out to see what living with them was like. Fled the group. He was away for 60 years. I mean, Murray says the mentor says he was 20 when he left. I mean, he's been away a long time. Shlach Lami had Tishlach died. He has someone who's been there, who knows them, who's a politician, who knows who's, you know, knows the people. I don't know them. So that's going to measure. And that really animates the whole objection at the Senate. These few Rashi's here tell us how to read the next one. It's only by Aminu Hashem of the Moshe Abdo, all is your Shem Moshe of the Israel. I'll say she does this thing, really feels so exciting. He becomes the greater prophet than he was before. And it's by Aminu Hashem of the Moshe Abdo. He never felt that before. So that's the background here. There's a similar thing, if you have time, to do with Yosef's brothers, who are going to Egypt not to get food. What? Yeah, read the Rashi, read the beginning of Rashi, prepared men bays. They're not going to get food. They have plenty of food. They don't need food. What are you doing, Rashi? What are they going for?
To find Yosef.
To atone. Rashi does say that. He says to find Yosef with it, to atone. And part of that meant to not get captured, making it fine. Okay? Alright, does this give you a little more to do, a little more of, to answer some of your questions you asked before? And now you have, what you need to answer week two. And but look up all the stuff from inside and see what, you know. There's also some questions about Milat Manchot in U3 that look up on your own and see. You'll find it. And it's hard to go wrong on the Milat Manchot, but usually it presents itself obviously. Right? So for the rest of today, look up some of these Rashis and Shmot Perek Yomot, and see what, by reading Perek Yomot and David, you see, oh my goodness, yes, that's exactly what's going on here. And even the Rashi's, Mi Alochi Kilecha Barao Chiyotiyat Neizom Mitzrayim. The Rashi says something about Moshe's wondering about what the Israel are and what they deserve. Who said anything about that, Moshe? Because that's what's bothering Moshe. God, the one day I had with them, they chased me out. Show on your back. Okay. Alright, sorry, I'm not in the proper place. So, you can leave the Chumash here with it.